generate the income and you make money. The money is both the capital and the income that is generated is yours, okay? So if the profit you made exceeds the annual expenses of yourself and your family, you have to pay homes from the excess, from the surplus amount, right?
The surplus amount of the capital of, or the
of
earning?
The, of the earning. Uh-huh. Of the earning.
But right? What about the capital?
The capital is assumed, as we assume that the homes has already been paid on the capital, right?
I see.
And the income, if it exceeds the annual expenditure of yourself and your family, you have to pay homes from the surplus.
I see.
And I think you are under the impression that, okay, since the capital is used, so it is something used.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't pay homes from something that is used.
Exactly.
That's not the case.
Uh-huh.
Okay, it's not like chair. It's not like, for example, yeah, the books or clothes that you wear, the coat that you wear, the handkerchief.
Right.
These are used objects. Homes is not payable on used objects. Something that is used, you have used it within the first year. Within
right.
the first year.
Uh-huh.
If you buy something from the market, a piece of clothing or a pair of shoes,
exactly.
and you use them within the first year,
right.
homes is not payable on them.
Uh-huh. I see. Thank you very much, Javid, for the clarification. It was a very nice, in fact, enlightening answer. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on iranradio.ir. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws, on Iran Radio, with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Shah Chavid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Shah Chavid, if a temporary marriage contract is concluded for a long time, let's say 99 years, is it still valid or considered as kind of temporary marriage or ruled as a permanent contract?
Well, according to the fatwa issued by His Eminence, Grand Ayatollah Khomeini, it doesn't make sense to fix the period of temporary marriage for such a long period of time, let's say 99 years. And in general, the validity of a long-term temporary marriage is problematic, as the example you gave.
Mm.
Because there is no possibility that the couple survive until that time. You know, the couple is already, let's say, 20 years. And 99 years, they are not going to live. And generally speaking, it's not possible for them to live for such a long years, for so many years, like 99 years. So it is problematic. It's a matter of objection.
Mm-hmm.
And when it's a matter of ishkal, then it means that the validity of such such a type of marriage, it's not going to be permanent marriage either.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, because the time is fixed, so it's not going to change into permanent marriage. So it's problematic.
I see. But if we reduce, for example, the number of years to 50 years,
that's okay.
Because, is it okay?
Yeah, why not? That's okay. 50 years is okay because it is people live more than 50 years. They live 60 years, 70 years. Okay, even 60, 70, it's okay.
Yes, yeah. I see.
But it
but
should
for
not...
A temporary marriage.
Yeah,
I mean,
temporary.
Like, it's not really sensible.
It's, if it's not, if it goes, if it exceeds beyond the normal span of your life, what's the normal span? You are going to be live for 70 years or 80 years at the most.
Uh-huh.
Okay? So if it exceeds the normal span of your life, then it is going to be problematic.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh, let's take another break and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, after the break. Stay with us.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina wa Nabiyina Muhammadin wa Ali.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws, on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, let me ask you a very general question, and then there are some sub-questions under it. You know, it's talking about, or it's somehow related to a dead fetus.
Yes.
Due to the genetic problem, the fetus has become dehydrated and immobile. And the mother, despite the effort and spending money to preserve the fetus, was forced to abort it by a specialist doctor. In this case, is it the mother's responsibility or Sharia duty to make ghusl or to do the ghusl of the dead body? One. And two, are parents to pay blood money or to do any act like that?
Well, first of all, ghusl is obligatory on the mother for two reasons. One, there are two causes of ghusl. The first cause is because of the bleeding. We call it nifas.
Yes.
Okay, the woman has discharged blood. She has given birth to a dead fetus,
mm-hmm.
and she has to observe, she has to perform ghusl for that reason. Another reason is that the fetus is dead, okay? And ghusl for touching a dead body becomes obligatory. Every mother that gives birth to a dead child must observe ghusl, must perform ghusl for ghusl for touching a dead body, because when the dead body was given birth to, then it came into contact with the body of the mother. The mother has to perform ghusl for touching a dead body. That is then another thing. So when it comes to the abortion, okay, I should say that if the, let's say, according to His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, if the fetus is at least 4 months old and is aborted dead, it is necessary for the mother to make ghusl for touching the dead body. This is the just a summary of the answer given by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. He has to, it's necessary for the mother to make ghusl for touching the dead body of the fetus, but if it died after abortion, it is not necessary for her to make ghusl for touching it. But of course, there is another ghusl, and that ghusl is the ghusl of nifas, because she gave birth to a dead fetus and she discharged blood. That's in it.
Yes.
And when it comes to abortion, of course, if the fetus has a soul, then due to obligatory caution, as a measure of obligatory precaution, the person who causes the abortion must pay the blood money. I mean, the person who was directly involved and who carried out the abortion. Maybe it is the doctor, maybe it is the father, and maybe it's the mother who took pills and caused the baby to die inside the womb.
What about who orders it?
And the person who orders is not responsible.
Liable.
Yeah, he's not liable. Okay.
I see.
And usually it is the doctor who carries out the abortion and carries out the...
Very quick question, Sheikh Ahmed, squeezing related to the first item of this question. I mean, you said that whoever touches, and usually the mother touches the dead fetus, and then she has to actually make ghusl, right?
Yes.
But what about the situation or the scenario where they are wearing gloves and they don't touch the body with bare hand?
The mother, of course, should perform ghusl because she gives birth to it. She does not wear gloves at that time.
Yes.
And that doesn't make sense.
But what about the doctors?
But the doctors, of course, they wear gloves. And ghusl does not become obligatory on them. Yes, because as long as there is a barrier.
Barrier recovery.
Yeah, yes. was does not become obligatory.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your program, Islamic Laws, on Iran Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, and the rest of the crew. We wish you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Black and white.
Ukraine.
Ukraine, a foreseen tragedy.
¿Quién pudo haber pensado alguna vez desde el 2014 cuando se inicia?
Who could have imagined since 2014 when the ultra-reactionary, even fascist and Nazi movements began in Ukraine?
Hasta la intervención especial de las tropas rusas.
Leading up to the special intervention of Russian troops, that Ukraine might serve Western interests in fragmenting Russia.
De fragmentar a Rusia, dividirla y dejarla en...
Dividing it into distinct countries, some serving Germany, others England, others the United States, and feeding off each other economically. The old decadent Europe looking for the resources that exist, from skilled Russian workforce to natural resources.
Tanto humanos, desde una mano de obra calificada, rusa, como naturales.
That was a fantasy, a gamble destined for failure. Today, Ukraine cannot participate. Donald Trump tells it, you have no cards to offer.
Tú no tienes ninguna carta que ofrecer. Más allá,
beyond the madness of going to World War III, that is not yet on the agenda in the interests of U.S. imperialism.
En los intereses del imperialismo norteamericano no está todavía colocada en la agenda.
Ukraine has to industrialize. A country without industry, without the capacity to produce what it needs to go to war, cannot get involved in a conflict of global proportions, especially against the enemy the United States designates, which is China. Because China has its own industry and a capacity that is self-sufficient. That is the difference. But Ukraine is the best example for the world to learn that when countries fall into the hands of the interests of imperialist powers,
de los potencias imperialistas,
small and medium-sized countries, they simply have no future.
No tienen ningún futuro. Y no pueden,
they cannot expect to escape this dependency or pursue an independent policy while serving those interests.
Es un drama lo de Ucrania.
Ukraine is a tragedy. Today, Ukraine faces over a million deaths, a devastated economy, and a massive wave of immigration, with many fleeing to Russia. Actually, it's important to note that a large part of the Ukrainian migrants have gone to Russia. In other words, a failed Ukraine with a failed state, with a dictator like Zelensky, who, as Donald Trump himself says, has not held elections and has essentially declared himself in power. You are nobody. This is how imperialism treats its lackeys, its servants, when they no longer serve them. It's a lesson that many around the world who serve such powers should heed. Ukraine provides a lesson to those who believe they will always be the darlings of the White House. Look how it's paying.
Miren cómo está pagando. Bueno, la vieja Europa, comillas, civilizada, esa misma...
Well, old civilized Europe, the same one that is endorsing the massacres of Syria and in Gaza, the Europe that supports Zelensky is also bankrupt and won't get away without following the United States guidelines. It lacks the capacity.
Seguir las orientaciones de Estados Unidos. No tiene capacidad.
Well, now this tragedy speaks about the need for sovereignty and social justice for the world, countries, and peoples.
Y la justicia social para los países y los pueblos.
This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. ¿Es posible que Ucrania hoy día esté absolutamente a la deriva?
Ukraine may currently feel adrift, relying heavily on support from Western European countries, particularly France and Germany. It's feasible for Europe to engage in a war with Russia through Ukraine without the involvement of the United States. This is possible both materially and politically. These are questions that people are asking. What is the current situation in Ukraine? What is the reality? Would a change in leadership at the White House lead to a shift in policy? What contradictions exist within American society that have contributed to this situation? To explore these topics further, we have a distinguished guest today. Joining us from Mexico is Dr. Ana Teresa Gutierrez del Cid, an expert in international relations with a specific focus on Russia and Ukraine. Welcome to Black and White, Ana Teresa.
Bienvenida a nuestro programa Negro y Blanco, Ana Teresa.
Muchas gracias, Eduardo.
Thank you very much, Eduardo. It's a pleasure to be on this program.
Ana Teresa, todo el mundo se pregunta.
Ana Teresa, everyone is wondering, is such a drastic political change really possible? How did the occupant of the White House shift their stance on Ukraine so quickly? What are the economic and political foundations behind this?
En fin.
Sí. Bueno, me parece que...
Yes, it seems to me that the American bourgeoisie is divided. On one side, we have the globalist, and on the other, figures like Trump and now Elon Musk, who not long ago was also a globalist. They're attempting to rebuild the economic and social fabric of the United States. This is evident, especially since Trump does not seem to support the broader American populace, but rather favors business owners by reducing their taxes. We are all witness to his erratic policies, including imposing tariffs, not only on trade partners like Mexico and Canada and European countries, but also making threats about taking Greenland. As we know, they'll have to go to a part of Canada. Overall, his approach is quite unpredictable, compared to the globalists, who also have detrimental policies affecting both the world and their own society. Well, we see that since the fall of the Soviet Union. We've seen how the world has been left adrift because the world order that existed based on the structure of Yalta and Potsdam Conference have collapsed, leading to increasing instability. The United States began to assert its influence over territories that were not rightfully theirs, especially during the Cold War, when the military strength of the Soviet Union acted as a restraining force. However, following the collapse of the Soviet Union, we have witnessed a shift. After the tragic events of September the 11th, the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, a member of the United Nations, followed by Iraq and then Libya, where they brutally killed its leader. The situation escalated to Syria, where Russia, having interest in the region due to its military base at the port of Tartus, also started to intervene. By 2017, Russia was no longer the weakened state it had been after the Soviet Union's dissolution. This shift aligns with the vision of strategist Zbigniew Brzezinski, a Polish aristocrat who became a key advisor in U.S. foreign policy. In his book, The Grand Chessboard, American Primacy and Its Geostrategic Imperatives, Brzezinski suggested that Russia should be divided into three parts: Western Europe to the west of the Urals, which would also serve as a source of cheap labor for the European Union and a market for European goods, and a central Siberia to the east of the Urals mountain.
A la derecha de los Montes Urales.
Anna,
we're going to take a short break and we will be right back.
Sure.
Thanks.
Estamos con Ana Teresa Gutiérrez desde México.
We're joined by Ana Teresa Gutiérrez from Mexico, delving into the current situation involving the United States, Russia, Ukraine, and of course, NATO. Ana Teresa, you provided a great overview of the goals pursued by those aligned with American financial capital. Today, we see a shift in leadership, perhaps leaning more towards industrial capital, with Donald Trump representing that change. Is it feasible for Ukraine to negotiate a ceasefire or peace amidst these contradictions and the challenges it faces, especially with NATO's involvement? Particularly, countries like England, France, and Germany have their own interests at stake. Given the contradictions, how capable are they of navigating the situation independently of the United States? What do you think about it?
Te dejo la reflexión.
Claro, sí. Bueno, hay que ver que,
Sure, yes, well, it's important to note that Biden continued Brzezinski's approach, turning Ukraine into an anti-Russian initiative. When Trump came into power, he adopted the strategy of another significant political thinker in the U.S., Kissinger. Kissinger consistently advocated, as we saw in 1971, for the separation of Russia from the Soviet Union and China. Today, the approach taken by the United States to counter China, which it views as a major competitor, and unfortunately as an adversary, involves trying to draw closer to Russia. This is evident in the narrative that many young people are dying and that Putin is not the villain the globalists portray him to be, but rather a capable leader. However, the American deep state clearly has no intention of stepping back from this conflict. I believe that behind the Europeans' action lies black soil, which had already been promised access to Ukraine's fertile land and its valuable resources. Ukraine also has raw materials. While Trump aims to win favor and believe he can claim Ukraine's wealth in a rather colonial manner, this blatant colonialism, this barbaric colonialism, is being met with resistance from the Europeans. They're not acting alone. They are also influenced by the interest of the American deep state. What we observe here is that Great Britain is taking the lead, still carrying some of those colonial attitudes from the 19th century that aims to spearhead a new initiative against Russia alongside Macron.
Esta nueva avanzada en contra de Rusia.
Ahora, Ana Teresa, pero es posible.
Is it possible for these countries to launch an advance similar to that of Hitler's Germany or Napoleon's France? Both of them ultimately failed against Russia or the Soviet Union in their times. Without the support of the United States and its military resources, this scenario raises questions. It's important to note that nearly 70% of the iron supplies in Western European countries come from American sources. And it could be a big business when today Donald Trump demands that those countries should arm themselves, buy weapons from the U.S. Here's our factory so you can arm yourselves. Or do you want us to give them away to you? What's going on there? Is it all about trades?
¿Qué pasa ahí? ¿Está el comerciante entre medio?
Claro, totalmente de acuerdo, Eduardo. Eso es.
Of course, I completely agree with you, Eduardo. That's exactly what's happening. Trump is trying to squeeze money from every possible source because of the double debt situation they're facing, both external, particularly with China, and the massive internal debt. The contrast between the U.S. government's financial struggles and its wealthy corporations is stark. Naturally, Trump wants to sell military supplies, but he also has prohibited the use of satellite technology to locate Russian troops that were being provided to Ukraine. As a result, Ukraine is losing ground. We can see that the Europeans are in a tough spot. It's often said that the European Union and its member states are militarily weak, a military dwarf, and have relied on the U.S. nuclear umbrella established after World War II, which they didn't have to pay for. Now Trump is looking to make money for this as well, suggesting that Europe should bear the cost instead of the U.S. spending more on Iran.
Y que gasten los europeos.
Así es, que gasten los europeos. Es posible que el paraguas nuclear de Estados Unidos.
That's right. Let the Europeans spend. It's possible that the U.S. nuclear umbrella could be replaced by France's, and there have been offers to Germany to establish a nuclear shield there. This could lead to a separation between the U.S. and Europe. What do you think?
¿Qué te parece a ti?
Pues yo no creo, porque son muy débiles.
Well, I don't think so, because they're very weak. They are very weak. And they have always been under the shelter of the American nuclear umbrella. And they're also countries occupied by NATO troops who are American. Above all, they have Germany. Consequently, they will likely conform to whatever the United States dictates, even if they're facing losses. They have invested a considerable amount of money, not to the same extent as the U.S., but still enough that it could have been used for welfare in Europe. Therefore, it seems to me that Europe cannot separate itself from the United States. They lack the military capability. We've seen how German tanks, including the U.S. Abrams tank, have succumbed against the Russian army. Since Vladimir Putin came to power in 2000, preparations have been underway for a potential confrontation with the West.
Con Occidente.
No, te iba a preguntar una cosa que es muy importante.
I was going to ask you something very important. What are the chances of Ukraine sitting at the table as a relevant player today? What are the possibilities that Ukraine has so far?
¿Qué tiene que ofrecer Ucrania?
Nada. Más que una.
It's nothing more than a ruthless colonization by the West. It's tragic that a million young Ukrainians have lost their lives. Men who could have started families that were vital for the economy and production of this nation. Today we witness a Ukrainian diaspora, most of whom, interestingly, are in Russia. There's nothing substantial to offer. It's merely a puppet, a result of the anti-Russian agenda that emerged in 2014. Following the coup against the president of the Party of Regions, Viktor Yanukovych, who understood how to navigate the ethnic dynamics in a country where the largest minority is Russian, primarily located in the wealthier Donbass region.
Que es en la cuenca del Don, en el Donbass.
Y con una economía que al mismo tiempo.
And with an economy that was simultaneously intimately linked to Russia, its production, its style. Now, is the Russophobia rampant in Europe possible without American oxygen?
Well, aquí, es que realmente, Eduardo, quienes perdieron más.
Well, Eduardo, the ones who truly lost the most are the Europeans. We saw how Germany was the driving force behind the European Union, successfully establishing Nord Stream 1, which allowed it to grow into a major industrialized and exporting nation after the unification in 1990. However, when the construction of Nord Stream 2 was set to begin, that's when Zelensky's madness erupted, influenced by the United States and other European nations. Even some factions of the German bourgeoisie shot themselves in the foot, because today Germany is now facing a recession. They are purchasing gas from the United States at 4 times the price they used to pay Russia, which provided it securely through pipelines in the Baltic Sea and overland routes. In a fierce interstate competition, the US has successfully taken the gas market away from Russia. Unfortunately, the European people are the ones who matter the least in this situation. Even now, the German bourgeoisie is feeling the impact as companies relocate to the US due to a law enacted by Biden allowing European businesses to move there because of the energy shortage in Europe. As a result, Europe has completely lost this battle, leading to dire consequences for its population.
That's right, Anna Teresa. Europe not only lost the war, but its people are also bearing the consequences. Nowadays, they need to allocate an additional 5% from their GDP on defense as members of NATO. Well, Anna Teresa, today's program has been excellent, and we really appreciate you joining us here on Black and White. Thank you so much.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte has given reassurances there are no plans for a sudden drawdown of American military forces from Europe. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Financial Times has covered the story and tells us more. The United States has no plans for a sudden withdrawal from Europe's defense, NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte has emphasized, adding that any shift towards Asia would be coordinated with European allies. Mark Rutte's comments on Thursday, 3rd of April, come amid rising concern among European capitals about Washington's long-term commitment to the European continent's security. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio told his European counterparts on Thursday, 3rd of April, that President Donald Trump supports NATO but wanted allies to commit to a realistic pathway for them to take on more responsibility for NATO's capabilities. Mark Rutte told reporters ahead of a meeting of alliance foreign ministers that there are no plans for them to all of a sudden draw down their presence here in Europe. But we know that for America, being the superpower they are, they have to attend to more theaters. Mark Rutte added, "We do everything in this alliance in the spirit of no surprises, of working together. If the Americans want to pivot more to Asia, obviously we will do that in a coordinated fashion." Donald Trump's move to restore ties with Moscow and his threats to withdraw U.S. protection for NATO allies who fail to spend more on defense have spooked European governments, who have responded by increasing military investments and discussing how they would mitigate the United States reducing its support for the European alliance. Marco Rubio said he wanted to hear allies commit to increasing defense spending drastically, with a new target of 5% of gross domestic product or GDP, up from 2% at present, to build up their military capabilities as Washington seeks to scale back its presence in Europe and refocus on other regions of the globe. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, standing next to NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte, said, "President Trump has made it clear we support NATO and we will remain in NATO. He's not against NATO. He's against a NATO that does not have the capabilities that it needs. Rubio added, "No one expects you will be able to do this in 1 year or two, but the pathway must be there. We do want to leave here with an understanding that we're on the pathway, a realistic pathway, to every single one of the members committed and fulfilling a promise to reach up to 5% of spending." He said, "That includes the United States." The U.S. Secretary of State dismissed reports of a possible reduction in U.S. troops or military presence in Europe as hysteria and hyperbole, but said the content needed to change its spending priorities. Marco Rubio added, "This is a collection of advanced economies, rich countries who have the capability to do more." He also stressed that that would require a change from European governments after decades of building up vast social safety nets. Euronews has also covered the same story and tells us more. The U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has reassured allies that Donald Trump is not anti-NATO and that the country will remain within the NATO alliance. But he's also asking his counterparts in Europe to make sacrifices and raise defense spending to 5% of GDP or gross domestic product. America's Secretary of State Marco Rubio has reassured NATO allies of U.S.'s commitment to the military transatlantic alliance at his first meeting of NATO foreign affairs ministers. Rubio recalled Donald Trump's message that the European countries and Canada need to further increase their defense spending. Rubio told reporters in Brussels, Belgium, the United States President Donald Trump made clear he supports NATO, and we're going to remain in NATO. He also stressed that the U.S. wants the alliance to be stronger against any potential threats. He said the only way NATO can get stronger and more reliable is if our partners, the nation states that comprise this important alliance, have more capabilities. The top U.S. diplomat said he expects to leave Brussels with a clear commitment from allies to spend 5% of their gross domestic product, or GDP, on defense, an increase from the current 2% of the GDP, which some European countries such as Belgium, Italy, and Spain still fail to meet. Rubio said, "I understand there's domestic politics after decades of building up vast social safety net that maybe don't want to take away from and that invest more in national security. But a full-scale ground war in the heart of Europe is a reminder that hard power is still necessary as a deterrent." Marco Rubio's comments come after Donald Trump said last month that the U.S. would not defend its European allies unless they increase their burden sharing within the NATO alliance. "It's common sense, right?" Donald Trump told reporters in the Oval Office in early March. "If they don't pay, I'm not going to defend them." The transatlantic alliance is currently assessing its capability gaps before committing to a new defense spending target, but a final figure is not expected until the annual NATO summit in June at The Hague in Netherlands. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte stressed that European NATO members have recently committed to the largest increase in defense spending since the end of the Second World War, though he agreed with the United States that much more needs to be done. The former Dutch Prime Minister and NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte said, "It's my assumption that what we need to spend, the Canadians and Europeans together, will be north of 3%. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio stressed that raising defense spending to 5% of GDP cannot be done in 1 year or two, but the U.S. now demands a real way forward from its allies to build a stronger NATO capable of defending its territories. The NATO chief also warned that the global security threats facing the alliance are increasingly interconnected, and that the Russian threat will persist for many years to come. The NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte said, "We're seeing what China is doing. We're seeing how these two theaters, the Inner Pacific and the Euro-Atlantic, are getting more and more connected by the fact that the Russians are working together with the North Koreans and with the Chinese. So we have to look at all these theaters in conjunction, and that will be our focus." European NATO members are also expecting clear messages or a roadmap from U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio regarding the U.S. withdrawal of troops from Europe, where around 100,000 American soldiers are stationed. However, the U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has not yet addressed the issue, and Mark Rutte indicated that no immediate drawdown of U.S. forces from Europe is planned. He said there are no plans for the U.S. military to all of a sudden withdraw from Europe, but we know that for America being the superpower, they have to attend to more theaters than one. Some NATO member states consider that the United States could reduce its presence by some 20,000 troops to 50,000 troops. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte acknowledged that the U.S. has long sought to pivot its ascension towards the Indo-Pacific region, but assured that it will be done in a very coordinated manner.
Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Cradle News Roundup, your one-stop shop for all news West Asia. My name is Esteban Carrillo. I am the news editor for The Cradle. And as usual, I'm joined by my colleagues, content creator and writer for The Cradle, Karim Shami, and content creator and social media manager for The Cradle, Sima Itayim. So as just to get into Yemen a bit, because I don't want us to go too long into it, but Yemen has become the target of the U.S. War, of these very intense attacks that have been happening. We talked about it last week. Again, we know this is not going to resolve at the end of a gun, but there's also Iraq, right? Like, Iraq is also been starting to get pressure to dismantle the PMU and all of these factions from Israel. But as Karim often puts it, right, Iraq is just going to do whatever is told. And then at the end of the list is Iran, right? With the letter from Trump to Khamenei and the threats that are continuing. We heard a few months ago that Israel was planning to launch attacks on Iran with the U.S. help in 6 months, right? They said by the fall, right? So, again, none of us here have a crystal ball, sadly, but the way things are going, it does seem like this has kind of become the status quo, right? And I think one of the places that you can see it clearly clearest is in Lebanon, where, again, the Israeli occupation army has continued to launch attacks, killing several people just over this weekend in the south, in the east of Lebanon, threatening to expand attacks on Beirut again, obviously threatening the airport, obviously threatening the usual things that they do, civilians, and the United States standing right behind them, saying, you know, we are willing to give you a freedom of action. At the same time, talking with the Lebanese leaders who are scrambling to put a stop to this in any way. But I feel like in Gaza, like in the West Bank, you as an Arab can do what you want to protect your people. But at the end of the day, if the biggest, the most powerful empire in history standing behind this genocidal, suicidal nation that is on a warpath, I don't think there's much that you can do, right? And I feel very concerned about what may come next for Lebanon, because now we're hearing, you know, over the weekend there was a rocket attack that was launched from Lebanese soil into a Metula settlement in Israel, and this was used to expand the air campaign. And then we were hearing some reports say that Israel may be trying to essentially do a false flag, right, to justify, dropping bombs in Beirut and just expanding their aggression. Because at the end of the day, they want us to roll over. They want everyone to roll over to tap out and just to say, okay, we will normalize with you. But at what cost, right? And who is willing to do it? What do you guys think about what's happening in Lebanon, about this escalation? Because it's been coming from Syria as well, not just from Israel.
Karim, before I let you go, I mean, it's a one-sided war. Lebanon's under constant attack. We saw attacks yesterday in the south that killed, a citizen. And by the way, guys, just pointing it out there, if someone is in Hezbollah but is not in combat, then it is a civilian. So I just wanted to make that clear to anybody.
These are the rules of war, right?
To anyone who was confused about that. So, you know, your stuff doesn't fly with me. Anyway, so we had like very, very, very brutal strikes. They started before this thing happened, where on Saturday, 5 primitive rockets were launched at the Israeli settlement of Umtalle or Metula. And in response, Israel unleashed a heavy wave of airstrikes, like very heavy, on both southern and eastern Lebanon. And Hezbollah, which typically claims responsibility for its operations, denied involvement in this rocket fire. I mean, if you see the photo of the rocket launches, you'll know it's not Hezbollah. I mean, I think it's just agents working for Israel trying to give them excuse, but they don't need an excuse. Again, they don't need an excuse, so not so sure. Israel claimed to have targeted, of course, Hezbollah infrastructure, including command centers and rocket sites, and the death toll is at least 8 people. And of course, they're saying they're doing this to protect their civilians. And of course, the Lebanese state has remained completely silent. You know, no condemnation.
Really?
Yeah, no statements. Oh, you're being sarcastic.
Breaking news.
No, just silence. Silence, you know. For the South, it's like, of course, once again, all these decades later, nothing has changed. The South is treated as though it's not a part of Lebanon. It's totally neglected. And to make matters worse, since the truce was signed in November, you know, Israel's reported it has violated the ceasefire not 1,000 times, not 1,500 times, but thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And, of course, continues to occupy these new 5 strike positions. And Hezbollah has intentionally taken a step back. Hezbollah is not in a great place, is it? Heavily targeted, not given a moment to breathe. Even its newer leaders that have been recently appointed are being targeted one by one. Anyway, Hezbollah has given the Lebanese government and army space to act, standing behind the army and allowing the state a chance to rise to the occasion. But let's be honest, that's leading nowhere. So we are under a one-sided war. And again, it's like, oh, thank you to the government for working to make sure that Beirut won't be hit, because the south isn't a part of Lebanon. We should only worry if Beirut is hit, right? And anyway, this is Lebanon without the resistance, you know? It's a Lebanon that plays into Israel's hands and that seeks complete inaction over justice at any price and, of course, bends to external pressure. Can't even muster up a statement to condemn strikes on its own land.
Currently in Lebanon and previously, and before even the assassination of Sayyid Hassan, Lebanon is either black or white. There is no gray part. You are either with Israel or against Israel. That's it. Previously, the majority or the power that Hezbollah possessed prevented the government to take some decisions, such as normalizing, and that's it. And they didn't use their power internally at all. Currently, the power has shifted, but the people are still the same. And the people that believe in retaliation and resistance are still the same percentage as before the assassination of Sayyid Hassan. But what happened now is that the power inside the government shifted, and now the people that are against Hezbollah are acting as if they were the people who fought Hezbollah, and they are taking decisions against Hezbollah as if they are the ones who won. Just to let you know how much the Israelis they are. They are not even Zionist. Zionist is like a very beautiful word for them. They are Israelis. There's no difference. I think they will push for everything. And even the Israelis will tell them, khalas, stop, as what happened last month. If you know Arabic and you're following the Lebanese journalists that are aligned with Israel and Saudi Arabia, you will see that they were pushing for normalizations in the media with Israel, and they are preparing the masses. They are saying, if not this week, next week. And now when you go to the streets in Lebanon, you will see, I think the normalization is before the summer. Next, the new school year you will have normalization. Mm-hmm. And the funny part is that the Israelis went out and said, no, we don't want normalization now because we have parts of your country. We don't want to make a new borders with Lebanon. We are happy as we are.
Yes.
And after that, the journalists and the people that go to the TVs, they stop talking about the normalization because Israel told them, no, that's not now, babies.
That's not what we want.
Talk about something else. So, in short, there's either black or white in Lebanon. You're either with or against Israel. If you're with Israel, currently you are pushing the narrative of the United States and the Israelis and the Saudi Arabians that everything is blamed on Hezbollah.
Indeed, Lebanon really is, between a rock and a hard place. It's a
By
country
the way,
that,
there's a drone. There's a drone now. It came back. It's hovering above Beirut. It's really loud.
That's been the status quo.
For the Lebanese army?
No. It's an Israeli drone.
We saw the Lebanese Air Force a few days ago when they bombed Syria with their World War II planes. Sadly, that is, again, the status quo, that nations need to heal, nations need to be bowed, against the occupier, against the genociders, right?
By the way, guys, this is Hossam. He was only 22 years old. You know him. This is the Al Jazeera correspondent, Hossam Shabbat. So, yeah, he was born in 2001. He's the second journalist they killed today, like within a span of less than 3 hours.
It's been 208 journalists killed. 208
maybe 209 now.
We saw it was one of the NGOs that tracked attacks against journalists that said a few months ago that the biggest cause of death for journalists in war zones for the past year and a half has been Israel, has been the Israeli army. So, again, this is kind of what has become normal, right? And just to finish my thought about what I want to say about Lebanon is that Lebanon needs billions to reconstruct for the damage that it has already incurred by the attacks, by the Israeli attacks, by the U.S.-backed war. This is money that is being offered, right, by the IMF, by the World Bank, by the Saudis, by the Qataris, etc., by the U.S., I guess. And everything's conditioned. Everything's conditioned and more likely than not conditioned on normalization. And as you guys said, more likely as Ghassan Kanafani said, right, the neck does not negotiate against the sword. And sadly, that is exactly the position that Lebanon finds itself in. But we will continue to discuss this as the weeks go on. I want us to move to Turkey, a nation we don't often discuss on its own, but that has warranted discussion over recent days because a huge protest broke out across Turkey, several cities, following the arrest of Istanbul Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu. Over 1,100 people arrested as of this recording, including 9 journalists. İmamoğlu, a prominent figure in Turkish politics and Recep Tayyip Erdogan's main rival, who could be considered, possibly the next president of Turkey in the upcoming elections in 2028, by the way. So Erdogan really acting way ahead of time to jail his competitors. Turkey at this point finds itself in a very interesting position following the fall of Syria, right? And they seem to have consolidated a lot of power, a lot of importance, in particular, as NATO members. They are in a way the keepers of Syria, no? Of the ISIS government that is currently governing there. And also, an interesting report that I want to mention is that last week the EU, a report comes out last week saying that the EU is apparently reconsidering allowing Turkey into the Union, right, to allow Turkey to become a full EU member. Why? Because they need a new arms dealer. They need to start buying weapons from someone else because now we know that Europe is on a desperate rush to start arming themselves for their, inevitable war with Russia now that the United States has essentially left them, standing out in the cold on their own. So all of a sudden, being friendly with Turkey seems to be the correct move for them. I just want to give that context to why, right, we are seeing essentially the breakdown of any, democratic pretenses that may have existed in the former Ottoman Empire to now become more of only Erdogan can be in power, only Erdogan can protect our interests, only Erdogan can move forward. So what have you guys heard, what have you guys seen about what's been happening in Turkey?
Hello. First, to be honest, I'm not that professional in Turkey issues, internal issues, but of course we all saw what happened. We saw that the mayor of Istanbul. Was detained, and yesterday he was jailed. Yani they jailed him on
officially, yes.
Yeah, officially jailed, and we know that the mayor in Istanbul, he was elected by the people of Istanbul, and this is a big difference. Yeah, in our region or in Lebanon, for instance, usually mayors are appointed, but he was elected. That means that the people elected him and they love him for the city. That's why we saw many people went to the streets. But the background story, I read many things, and some people say that because he was. He had his education in Cyprus, and it was revoked. And with him, like 106 people were also their education was revoked. But the point is that, as you said, it's of course it's political. Yeah, and if he was from his party, this won't happen, and we all know this.
If he was from the AKP, right? That's Erdogan's party.
So, and the point is that I don't know his ideology. Yani maybe both him and Erdogan is good for the country or bad for the Turkey, but we discuss here what's good and bad for the region. I don't know the stance of the mayor of Istanbul. Do you know about him? Do you know? Yani he's good with Iran. He's good with the United States. He's good with Israel. Yeah, we have to know this.
I would imagine he's not, you know, a very pro-resistant character.
I don't know, but what's happening here now currently in Turkey, as I see it, as a person who's not like too much into Turkey, this either will make Erdogan the ultimate leader for maybe at least one decade or two decades to come, or it will weaken him. We have to wait and see. And we know that Turkey now has like foots in many places in Libya. If Erdogan is weakened, because this is Erdogan's policy, I don't think this is the policy of Turkey. We have to differentiate this. And of course, Syria will be weakened if he's weakened. Or if he gets the full power, then he can do whatever he wants in Syria, in Qatar, in Libya. We have to wait and see.
Well, like, just to give a bit of a rundown in case there's anyone watching who has no idea. So he was, formally arrested yesterday on corruption charges, but also was previously detained for not only corruption, but terror links, you know, to the PKK. So the court accuses him of everything from embezzlement to rigging bids to unlawful data collection. And he called this, like, unimaginable slander. And he put out all these things on social media, like, I will never bow down and we will get through this and whatever. So initially, before yesterday, he was like formally arrested yesterday. So he was detained in a dawn raid earlier this week, just as his party, which is the CHP, began endorsing him as a 2028 presidential candidate. So, you know, the timing, you know, says a lot. And so, as you guys mentioned, his university diploma was revoked the day before his arrest. So this sparked what we can safely call the largest street protests in Turkey in over a decade across the country, and they were defying a four-day protest ban that the government enforced. They enforced a protest ban, and of course we saw riot police with tear gas and pepper spray and all that, and you mentioned the mass detentions. But so the point is, many analysts, including those who work with us here at the Cradle, see this as a political purge, you know, of course not a legal process. You know, it's an attempt by him to remove his strongest political rival, I guess, you know, ahead of the election. Because this guy is not, he's more than a mayor. He's like a national symbol of political hope for
because
many Turks.
When he's elected for Istanbul mayor, he defeats Erdogan's candidate, right? The CHP defeats the AKP candidate by like 20,000 votes. And some backroom maneuvering by the governing party in Turkey, which, by the way, Erdogan has been president for 23 years in Turkey. They rerun the election, right? They do it again, and then the second time he wins by almost 1 million votes, right? So if anything, this sort of persecution works in his favor, and I would imagine. Down the line, it's probably going to continue to work in his favor after what happened last week. What I want to bring up to attention, right, is the parallels of what happened, what Erdogan has done over the past week with İmamoğlu, with what happened with Imran Khan in Pakistan, right? When this very popular prime minister is removed from office in a legislative coup, sent to prison, given dozens of charges on everything, right? Just buried in legal cases, him and his wife thrown in jail. His party is persecuted. His followers are persecuted. It becomes a war, right? In Turkey, it becomes a war against the PTI, if I'm not mistaken. That's Khan's party. In Turkey, it seems to be the same playbook in a way, and because that's the empire playbook, right?